I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, the tennis podcast by fans. On today's episode, backed by our crowd funders, Anna Kirk and Caroline Gerling.
Sasha Zverev takes his second Madrid title.
Sabalenka beats Barty with a bagel.
And the Billie Jean King Cup Finals are looking for a new home.
Kim, the Madrid Open has just come to a close. We've just had the men's final, Sasha Zverev versus Matteo Berrettini. The Italian Open, I think, has already started. So it really is kind of all hands on deck at the moment. There's just continuous clay court tennis and we're in this sort of back-to-back Masters, I guess, transitionary period at the moment.
Yeah, and it would have been good in a way if we'd have had Rome postponed a week like there were rumours at one point would happen because of the French being put back. But yeah, that would have allowed us a bit of room to breathe. But no, I mean, we shouldn't complain, Joel, because it's great having this much tennis on, especially the after the dearth of last year. So yeah, I'm all here, down for that, ready to go. And I mean, let's start with Madrid, because as you said, we have just had the final between Zverev and Berrettini. A final that neither of us predicted. I think that's fair to say. Although I think you did say Berrettini would have a good run, and that was obviously proved right.
Yeah, I mean, he's been in really good form since he's been coming back from injury. I slightly suspected that Madrid was going to suit kind of the big server, big ground straight players, given Madrid is, you know, the altitude is obviously a factor. And I think we've seen that this week, particularly with the final. We've had two sort of big forces, I think, with, as I said, with their serves and their forehands really come to the fore. We've seen John Isner as well have a pretty decent week coming out of nowhere. So I really felt that this tournament was made for, you know, those players with kind of dominating services. And that's what we got. We got a final between Zverev and Berrettini. And it really was a question of, you know, who was going to bring their A game on the day, because I felt that both players had shown very, very good tennis, you know, throughout the week. It was just going to see what gave first, really.
Yeah, and you could also say that this tournament is pretty much made for Sasha Zverev, because he's actually got a really good record at this event. He's got a 15-2 record now in Madrid. And I think across all the Masters tournaments, this is by far and away, you know, his best one. And this is his second title at this event. And actually, it's been 3 years since he actually won a Masters event. So it's been quite a long time, really, for someone of his ranking to have gone so long, you know, after kind of his initial breakthrough winning Masters back in 2018. But yeah, he came through, obviously, in three sets today, dropping that first set on the tiebreak. He had a set point, wasn't able to convert it. So Berrettini, you know, took that first set. But Zverev, you know, stayed very calm, came back to win the next two sets, 6-4, 6-3. And yeah, I mean, I think his serve really this week has been pretty on point. And we know with Zverev that his game is very dependent on how well his serve is getting on. And you could really see that this week. He had a lot of confidence with the serve, especially.
I mean, we all know his issues with his second serve particularly. But it felt like this week, you know, was a very kind of mature, I think, performance, and one that I think showed his sort of mental maturity more than anything. He came through some very kind of tricky matches. You know, we'll get on to kind of talking about that Nadal match, but yeah, he just loves playing in Madrid. I mean, I don't think he played tennis as good as when he won it the first time round. I think I was reading he won that tournament without even facing a break point, but it seems that conditions are absolutely kind of made for him. And, you know, against Berrettini in the final, you know, I think experience did tell a little bit. I felt, you know, Berrettini, you know, this was his first, you know, Masters level final. And, you know, although he went a set up and he played really, really well until, you know, around sort of 4-4 in that second set, you just felt that he got a little bit tight You know, maybe he was thinking, oh, I could be winning my first, you know, Masters 1000 trophy. And I think that's when Zverev and his sort of maturity, I think, kind of told. And really, when it came to the, you know, the business end of that second set, he was able to kind of, you know, put his foot on the gas. And, you know, when he went a break up in the third set, you just felt like he wasn't really going to let it go. And I think what was so impressive about it was the fact that, you know, this time, like last week, you know, we weren't really talking about Zverev as a contender. You know, he'd lost to Ilya Ivashka in Stuttgart, you know, in one of the early rounds. We didn't really know what sort of form he was in, but he is just able to kind of turn it on. And this was just a reminder of his, you know, of his ability on a tennis court, and the fact that, you know, on his day, on any court, you know, he can beat anyone in the world.
I feel like it was Munich that he lost to Ivashka, but I may be wrong. Bavarian tournament.
Oh, sorry. Yes, it was Munich. I keep thinking it was Stuttgart. I don't know why.
You're getting the mixed up. It's all right.
Stuttgart was the women's tournament between Barty and Sabalenka. Anyway, yeah.
Very easy to mistake it, Joel. I mean, Barty, Zverev, they look exactly the same, don't they? anyway, we'll get on to Barty a bit later as well. But yes, I mean, Zverev, you know, obviously beating Rafa in the quarterfinal, beating Dominic Thiem in the semifinal, who, you know, fair to say, not the player of last year at the moment. But and then obviously Berrettini in the final. So that's three top teners in a row to win this title. And yeah, I think it really came down to just those at 4-4 in the second set, you know, Zverev capitalised on a couple of errors from Berrettini, you know, when it was getting a bit tight. So came through. And yeah, I mean, it's, where does this put him now? Because I wasn't really thinking about him as being in the equation going into Madrid. And now I'm thinking, is he a dark horse for going far at the French? I really don't know. It depends, I guess, how well he keeps it up.
Because we were all talking about, you know, we were all on about Tsitsipas last week. And, you know, his win, you know, sorry, his final against, you know, Nadal. And, you know, now Zverev's kind of come back, and yeah, it's really been a bolt. I feel it's really been a bolt from the blue. I still think, you know, he's still got, I think, work to do. You know, I think in this match, you know, he would have felt like going into it, obviously he was the favorite, but I still think on court, his demeanor, you know, I think there are a few kind of points where he always looks, I don't ever feel like he looks comfortable on a tennis court or like he enjoys playing. He always seems to be worried. Or, you know, when his opponent kind of hits a winner or whatever. But I just think that he can do a little bit more in terms of having a more positive kind of attitude. As I said, he always kind of looks a bit worried when his opponent is playing well and doesn't really know kind of what to do. But I think he should just kind of, you know, back himself. And it looks like, you know, his serving is obviously a big part of that. And, you know, he's going to have to obviously make sure that he keeps the, you know, the double faults down in single digits. But, you know, we've got to remember that even though it can be one of his weaknesses, and he's shown that in the past, it's also one of his biggest strengths. And we saw that this week. We saw that also with Berrettini this week, because his serving was, you know, very, very good. I think it's, you know, his actions, I guess, a little bit more orthodox. I think it is a little bit more kind of consistent, but, you know, both players have very big serves. And, you know, I think particularly with Berrettini, he is able to kind of back that up with that massive forehand. And I think that was really his story kind of throughout the week, in terms of making sure that, you know, he's got a very kind of smart tennis brain, and he was making sure that when he kind of placed his serve, he was doing it in a way that made sure that he could get to his forehand and really kind of unload on that. And, you know, no players until Zverev really kind of had an answer to it, because he did look very impressive this week also.
Yeah, he had some wins over Casper Ruud, Christian Garin. Obviously, Ruud in good form at the moment, and Garin is a very competent clay courter as well. So, I mean, Berrettini was trying to become only the second Italian to win a Masters event. Obviously, Fognini won Monte Carlo a couple of years ago. So, Berrettini, you know, not many Italians have actually been, you know, at this stage of a Masters event. And I mean, Jannik Sinner didn't have a very good week, did he? He lost to Popperin early on, so
no.
That was a bit of a shame to see him having a bit of a duff week.
I think what's interesting about Berrettini is that, you know, at the moment, you know, we are, I think, you know, as tennis fans, all sort of, you know, looking forward to and hearing about, you know, players like Sinner and Musetti from Italy. But I think we've got to remember that, you know, players like Berrettini, I think he is the real deal at the moment, in terms of, you know, someone who is, you know, well developed for the, you know, the here and now. You know, we've seen that, you know, we've seen that over the last few weeks on the tour, particularly on the clay game. I think, you know, there are improvements he can make. You know, I still think, he's got work to do on his backhand. I think, you know, if I was a player and coming up against Berrettini, I would be looking to play into that backhand, because I still think it's a bit of a, yes, I mean, he had a few winners off his double-handed backhand today, but I still think there's a potential kind of source of weakness. But I mean, he's doing really well at the moment. He's back in the top 10. And, you know, I think, you know, what he'll be looking to do is, as I said, kind of develop, I think, a more kind of all court game, maybe something that, you know, Zverev already has off the forehand and the backhand wing at the baseline. I think that's potentially something that Berrettini, you know, could aspire to, because I thought his single-handed slice backhand was very good in sort of killing any sort of power from the other side of the court. But maybe there's a little bit more he could do with the double hander.
Yeah, I think Berrettini, for me, he just needs that killer edge when it comes to the very top players to, you know, to get him to the next level. And actually, talking about Italians in Masters final, Sinner did get to the Miami Masters final, which I've just forgotten about and remembered. So there we go. Anyway, let's touch quickly on Rafa, because, yeah, losing to Zverev in that quarterfinal. I thought when Rafa was 4-2 up in the first set, oh, this is nice. I can, you know, have a relaxing afternoon watching my favourite player, you know, sort of not cruise, but, you know, have a good win here. And then, lost that first set, 6-4, and then break down in the second set. And before you know it, Zverev had got over the finish line. And it was a bit sort of like, oh, okay. I thought Rafa'd got... Monte Carlo.
I know. I mean, I was a bit surprised. You know, I thought this was just going to be a routine victory for Rafa. As I said, you know, Zverev was coming into this tournament, you know, off losing to, you know, Ilya Ivashka. So I was surprised by it. And the fact that it was in straight sets as well. I don't know how much we can read into it, because we've spoken about, you know, the conditions in Madrid. They are not like the conditions in Paris. And, you know, arguably the conditions favour someone like Zverev. And, you know, that was shown, because he went on and won the tournament. But, you know, it does feel at the moment, though, in kind of the context of their rivalry, it does feel like Zverev does have the, you know, he does have Rafa's number at the moment.
Well, he has beaten him three times in a row now. And two of those were on hard courts, indoor hard courts at the World Tour Finals, or ATP Tour Finals, I should say, and the Paris Masters indoors last year. So, yeah, it's three in a row isn't great, but I do like what you said. You know, they're all surfaces that, apart from clay, obviously, but this is a different sort of clay, as we've discussed. It's not clay, is it? It's kind of... You know, Madrid is the tournament that Rafa's had the least success at, I suppose, out of all of the clay events. So, you know, he's only won it five times. I say only, but for any other player, that would be a fantastic achievement. But it is still a fantastic achievement. But, you know, it's compared to 12 of another title, it's, you know, pales in significance.
I do think with Zverev, his frame and his, you know, he's so tall, right? And I do think that means, therefore, you know, the ball doesn't climb up on him as much as maybe it does with a shorter player. And I think that does kind of help him, you know, when he does play Nadal, in terms of that, you know, that heavy, heavy topspin, he's able to kind of get on it kind of naturally because of his height. That for me is where I feel like he can sort of nullify that threat a little bit. And that may be why he has had kind of success with him, but it is still quite surprising. But again, it is kind of a testament to how good Alexander Zverev is on a tennis court.
Yeah, no, exactly. Fair dues to him. I'm going to go with the Rafa's doing everything in alternate weeks, so he'll be back on it. I mean, and we'll win Rome.
are you worried, or are you a bit, are you on edge?
I think we have to wait till the Grand Slam, best of five sets. You know, I don't think Rafa will be in his room crying about this Madrid tournament. So I will just, you know, wait and see. certainly Rafa's had better clay seasons, but, you know, he is almost 35 years old, and you've got to focus on the most important tournaments, haven't you, now? And I don't think, you know, you should lose sleep about these kind of things. It's ultimately, it will come down to Roland Garros, and that is the most important thing. So we will get there when we get there. But I mean, Rafa could be having a worse clay season, Joel, and one player that isn't having a very good clay season so far is Daniil Medvedev, because he was having a right old Barney on court against, well, he was playing Alejandro.
That's
his first. Alejandro Davidovich Fokina. God, that is a mouthful, isn't it, sometimes? And yeah, it wasn't going particularly well for Medvedev. He got a bit annoyed, was battering the court, and the umpire had a bit of a go at him. And, you know, classic Medvedev, basically getting all worked up and not having the best week on clay.
I love how, yeah, he took his frustrations out on the court, and he's, and you know, he got a warning from the umpire, and he said, in his response, he said, "I cannot do damage to a bad surface. It's already damaged." And I absolutely love this play out for the fans on television of Medvedev trying to figure out a clay court, because, you know, some players obviously would try and do it, you know, off court or off TV, you know, in the, you know, on the practice courts, etc. But I do feel like we're just witnessing Medvedev, you know, in real time, just try and figure out how he plays the surface. Because the funny thing is that he's done quite well on this surface in the past. And he's got some pretty big wins on this surface in the past. But regardless of that, he just it just feels like he absolutely hates it. And even when he's winning, he just doesn't like it. And, you know, there's probably a bit of him is like, oh, when can we get to, you know, when can we get back to the grass court season, or, you know, when can we get back to a, you know, a faster court surface? But, you know, I think he's got to remember that, you know, if he wants to be one of the best in the world, he's going to have to be able to do it all year round. And, you know, when he figures out how to play, you know, clay court tennis and get to semi-finals and finals again, is anyone's guess. But it's absolutely fantastic kind of watching him figure it out on, you know, watching him try to figure it out on court.
Well, exactly. And, you know, again, is the right word, because he did reach the final in Barcelona two years ago. So it's not like he can't do it. It's just getting into that headspace, I suppose.
Maybe he doesn't like to do the washing afterwards because of all the clay stains that he gets on his nice outfits.
Yeah, I'm sure he stays up all night, you know, doing his laundry. but yes, a couple of other things, Joel, before we go on to discuss the women's event. We had a few different things happening this week, I suppose. We've got Fox 10, which is kind of the Hawkeye that's been developed for clay. So that was being trialed this week. And fair to say, probably didn't go that well, because there's still a lot of issues with regards to the marking, you know, the ball and how this new technology actually picks it up, you know, as an alternative to obviously that the line judges and the umpires deciding. And I don't think the players are particularly convinced by Fox 10. It's very difficult to track a ball on clay. And I just don't think there's been enough success with this technology for it to carry on. I mean, I don't know. It's early days, but I really don't. I think there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I think judging from some of the, you know, the situation involving it and, you know, seeing some of the players' reactions, it definitely felt like they were a bit, yeah, they were definitely a bit kind of skeptical of it. You know, from a fan point of view, I quite liked the, you know, the visual that kind of comes out on it. I mean, we've seen it before. We're seeing it for the first time on a clay court, but I do like the sort of the real photographic style visual that you get on the big screen. But it just, for me, the fact that it kind of goes in kind of that slow motion in that black and white, it just shows how much added complexity there is to, you know, marking a ball on a clay court versus any, you know, all the different other types of court surfaces. You know, does it hit the line kind of flush on? Does it skid off the line? You know, it's not as clear cut as on other courts, and that's just what makes it so difficult. And, you know, this is not a new thing. You know, we're constantly, you know, having this debate on, you know, should there be Hawkeye on the clay court, or, you know, can we rely on umpires just kind of going down and kind of pointing at a ball mark? But yeah, it still feels like there's sort of work to be done there, and maybe it should be done in, you know, lesser profile events. I was sort of a bit surprised, actually, they were going to roll it out at a, you know, a Masters 1000 on the show court. Maybe it could have been done at a, you know, a more lower level sort of test event, but I'm not sure. Maybe, you know, the Caja Magica is like the only, you know, it had the facilities able to kind of implement the technology. But yeah, it does feel like there's still quite a bit of work to be done there.
Yeah, I think it will be a while before it is properly rolled out. I mean, if at all, because it hasn't really resolved the...
Do do you want to see it rolled out, or would you, are you happy with just, you know, an umpire just getting off his chair and
or her chair
or her yeah or just bumbling or just like pointing out a spot on the, you know, near a baseline or a tram line?
Well, if the technology isn't going to be accurate either, then you pay, what's the point in paying for it? Why would a tournament pay for it when they can just, you know, have the umpire do it? If it's going to be, you know, if a player's going to get worked up over an umpire's call, Fox then isn't necessarily going to resolve that if that's also just as inaccurate potentially as a human eye. It's just tricky, isn't it, with clay generally? So we will, it remains to be seen. It's a very diplomatic answer.
They just, Kim, they just need to rake the court after every point, and then we'll just have no issues in terms of what the ball mark is.
That would be quite, I'm up for doing that. I think that'd be a great exercise, good for the arms, and I could then...
Rafa would love that, because it would add a little bit of extra time for him to get ready for the next point.
Yeah, while he's fiddling around with his pants, I'll just run across the court quickly, sweeping it, and Bob's your uncle, I can watch the tennis live and get employed to do, you know, court work. But I mean, also in Madrid, you know, the second court, the Arancha Sanchez,
oh, God,
awful, yeah, shadows, where depending on time of the day, you know, watching it on telly, it's not good, is it?
No.
It's like half the court's in darkness.
It's really bad. It's really, yeah, bad.
I don't know what they can really do about that, but I know we've seen this at other places, and it's just... Yeah, I mean, they'll have to fiddle with maybe the lighting on the TV. You know, is there a way they can... I mean, I'm not very technical, but you know what I'm trying to say. But
they,
yeah,
need to,
not,
yeah,
not a good design.
They need to contact the best architect in Madrid or whatever to go and sort that problem out, because it's just not good. It's not good for the players. It's not good for the fans. You know, going from, you know, really bright on potentially one side to kind of complete darkness on the other side. You know, that just adds another layer of challenge to, you know, for, I imagine, for players. It makes it really hard to see the ball. It's just not a good look. So I hope next year we can be in a situation where we're not talking about the lighting and the shade on that second court, because it's probably the worst I've ever seen it, I think, as a fan. On TV. I mean, listeners, let us know, are there any other courts out there that you know are notoriously bad for it? Because I do think the Arancha Sanchez court, it was just unwatchable at times.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Let's talk about the women's event, Joel, obviously, which concluded on Saturday. And world number one, Ash Barty, who was on a 16-match winning streak on the red clay, that is, and has obviously been picking up titles left, right and centre so far this year. She's lost. She has been beaten by a fellow top tenner. We were talking about, you know, recently about Ash Barty's excellent record against other top 10 players. But Sabalenka had her number in the final on Saturday. Quite an interesting match. It was 6-love in that first set to Sabalenka. Barty took the second 6-3, and then Sabalenka came out on top 6-4 in the third set. So this was their third match of the season. Barty had won the previous two. So a nice little bit of revenge for Sabalenka to overturn, you know, the way that those matches were going, and to win her, well, I think it's her third title of the season, I believe. She's really racking up the titles as well. I mean, I suppose her and Barty have been the two players over the past few months that have kind of consistently been in the most form.
Yeah, it was really, really, really impressive from Sabalenka, particularly, I think, after she lost that second set. I think a lot of people, including myself, thought, you know, once Barty had won that second set, you thought, you know, she had figured out the Sabalenka game and how to, you know, nullify the, you know, the power that she brings to the court. But, you know, fair play to Sabalenka for kind of coming back and winning that third set. I mean, everyone, I think, is going to be talking about that first set, though, because, I mean, 6-love against the world number one. After, you know, she's on a 16-match, you know, win streak on red clay. I mean, it was in a final. It was just something I don't think anyone of us was expecting. I mean, it was Ash Barty's first bagel, receiving a bagel in 4 years, and just the eighth in her entire professional career. So that is something that doesn't happen very often. But I mean, Sabalenka at the moment seems to be on an absolute warpath, and, you know, through to the final, she was really, really ruthless. I don't think she dropped more than three games in a set or en route to the final. You know, we know her as a very much a power player. And I think this week, what was really impressive was she was able to, I think into the final, you know, she was hitting more winners than unforced errors, because we know that she can be, I think, a little bit erratic at times. But I think what's so scary about Sabalenka is if she's able to kind of keep it in the plus differential in terms of, you know, winners to unforced errors, I do genuinely think she could beat, you know, she could beat anyone in the world.
Yeah, when she's on, she's really on. And yeah, that first set, I think she only hit like one unforced error. Her serve was right on. And obviously,
it was scary.
She didn't keep that level up the whole match, but she did what she needed to in that third set, you know, picked up the aggression a bit more in those key moments, really helped her, you know, come through. And I think that was, you know, the impressive thing. It's like, yes, she played lights out in that first set, but also when it was closer in that third set, you know, she was able to come through as well. And the last player that bageled Ash Barty was Muguruza in 2017 in Toronto. So yeah, that was quite a long time ago now. And also, I just need to correct myself. It's Sabalenka's second title of the season, not her third. So my bad. But she is now up into the top five, Joel. She's now going to be number four in the world, so she's certainly on the way up, even more, going in the right direction. And I feel like, obviously, we've spoken before about whether she can do it at a Grand Slam now, but I think it's the consistency of having wins like this that's going to help her get there. And I think what's interesting this week, she said she's kind of got a new approach to clay as a surface, and previously I think she's been really trying to change her game to adapt to it, but actually she's kind of simplifying things and just kind of thinking, okay, yes, I need to use a bit more spin and adapt slightly, but you don't need to lose like the real core essence of your game and get completely bemuddled and befuddled in, you know, changing your strategy completely to suit the surface, when otherwise you can, I guess, lose what makes you such a good player generally as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, in that bottom half, you know, we've got a player like Naomi Osaka. You know, we spoke on our last podcast losing to Mukova, and you know, I feel like both those players have quite similar games, you know, in terms of, you know, like to, you know, keep the rally short on a hard court, you know, like to hit winners, etc., you know, from the baseline. And I think Naomi Osaka, you know, she's looking at how she plays, you know, how she needs to play on a clay court to kind of compete with the very best. I think she, you know, could look at Sabalenka in terms of a role model, really, in terms of how you play, you know, that power game on a clay court and how you can adapt it, you know, to face someone like Ash Barty. We spoke about Osaka not being the greatest mover, you know, going for it from the baseline when, you know, maybe it was just maybe to be a bit more defensive and wait your moment. And I think kind of Sabalenka has sort of figured that out and is one step further down the path than Osaka in that respect. And I think that's, you know, really showing at the moment. And I think what's so fascinating about it is that, you know, we were probably talking about Sabalenka, you know, if she was going to win a Grand Slam, we probably would have said kind of US Open on a hard court. But, you know, with this victory and kind of the players she kind of beat, you know, through to the final, you know, Lise Mertens, you know, Ash Barty, you know, Pavlyuchenkova in the semifinals as well. She, I think, has announced herself on the clay this season. And I do think she has put herself, you know, up there with the, you know, the main contenders, really, for the French Open. I definitely think she's going to be, I definitely think now with this title, she's going to go in as one of the favourites.
Yeah, beating her doubles partner, of course. Well, kind of ex-doubles partner. I mean, they sort of half-play together,
doubles,
don't
partner,
they?
Yeah,
it's a weird relationship. And Pavlyuchenkova, nice run to the semis for her. And also for Paula Badosa, who I think was like the first Spanish woman in a long time to get to that stage. So nice stories emerging from Madrid.
Pavlyuchenkova, I watched some of that semi-final, Kim. She genuinely looked scared by how powerful Sabalenka was hitting the ball from the baseline. I mean, it was two in love. And I think, you know, Pavlyuchenkova just, she was a little bit like deer in headlights. I mean, I was so happy for her to get to the semifinals, but it was like, you know, Sabalenka's tennis was just, it was just scary, scary good. And that for me is the thing that is so scary about it, is that what it's like, what happens if she doesn't miss? She's just going to kind of go, you know, go through her opponent. And, you know, even someone, you know, like an Ash Barty, who's got all of these tricks of the trade and knows how to, you know, work her opponent, etc., it still feels like if there is an ultra aggressive player who just on their day has one of those moments against, you know, the world number one, it feels like Ash Barty is a bit sort of powerless to do anything.
Yeah, I agree. It's an all power game. We've said this before, but yeah, Sabalenka is a force to be reckoned with. But when it's on, you're like, it's whether you can actually, you know, can she do that like at a slam for seven matches consistently? We shall see. But just one thing, I love how you've you know, written on our notes here, you owe Elise Mertens an apology, Joel. What's that about?
I do. Because I said in our predictions last week, I said, I don't care. I think this is going to live in sort of passing shot infamy from now on. But I said in the last podcast, I don't care how good the form Elise Mertens is in. She's going to lose 3 and 4 to Simona Halep. And what happened? She went and beat Simona Halep. So Elise Mertens, this is my, I hope you can accept my apology. Playing great tennis, and I should have never have doubted you and the form that you're in. But yeah, no, really good win. Really good win for Mertens against Halep, because, you know, I still think Halep is definitely one of the French Open contenders. Not really been at the races so far, I think, in Madrid. Yeah, Mertens definitely, I think she's keeping up that consistency. And I should have recognised her for that, Kim.
And before we go for a break, Joel, we also had another women's event in Saint-Malo in France, which was won by Victoria Golubic. She came through against Jasmine Paolini in straight sets in the final, 6-1, 6-3. So this was a 1-2-5 event. So, it had sort of players that, I guess, lost early in Madrid, went off to play this one. And Golubic, yeah, she's having quite a bit of a resurgence, because she won a title earlier in the season. I think this is her fifth final of the year. So she's really, really racking up, going deep into events. And, she won through against Paolini. I mean, perhaps a dark horse, you know, someone at a slam that you really don't want to come up against in the early round, because obviously she won't be seeded. She actually could have lost early on. She was 3 match points down to Greet Minnan in the second round, came through that one, and then obviously went all the way on to win the tournament, which I find happens quite a lot with players who, you know, come back from the brink of defeat, win through. They seem to often end up sometimes going all the way. It's like it was meant to be.
I mean, she's in really, really good form this season. I mean, it might be going under people's radars because, you know, some of those wins are just below the, you know, the WTA kind of tour level. But I mean, a player who, you know, has got over 30 wins now this season, she's 31-6, is definitely going to be someone that, yeah, you don't want to face. And, you know, you've seen on the men's side, you know, players in this sort of, you know, just racking up the rins just below the surface come through, you know, like a Karatsev, you know, Ivashka as well. You know, we saw Podoroska last year, you know, come out of nowhere. So it definitely could happen. And, you know, Golubic is definitely one of those players who is very, very handy on her day and is just kind of carrying on her form, you know, all the way through, whether that's on hard court, clay court, whatever, indoor court. So yeah, she's doing really, really well at the moment. I mean, five finals in her 8 tournaments she's played in 21. I mean, that just, I don't care what level you're in. I don't care what kind of sort of state the status that the tournament is. That sort of form just shows you're playing good tennis.
Yeah, whether it's ITF, some of those are ITF events, but it's like wins are wins, and it's having that confidence and just getting used to that winning feeling can definitely work wonders when you do get to the higher level events. So if she can get her ranking higher, you know, and be consistently up there, then, you know, she can go further places. I'd love to see her getting up there. So we're going to take a quick break now, but do join us in the second half. We'll be looking at all the news from the last week, Stritskova's retirement, the Billie Jean King Cup location debate, and also looking at the draws in Rome and previewing that event. So join us in a second. This is The Passing Shot. You're joined by Joel and Kim, and we are now in the second half of today's podcast. We're going to begin, as always, Joel, with a bit of mysterious player before we go back to all the news and events from the world of tennis. So going to go back a bit in time, and I'm going to give you a player to guess. Are you ready?
I'm scared, Kim, because I know I gave you a pretty hard one last week. So I'm nervous whether you've gone like completely sort of really niche for me just to make it that much harder.
I know you gave me a difficult one, but Joel, but I can't remember who it was now from last week. It's gone completely out of my mind.
It was Jelena Dokic. I know you've...
Oh, that was it, yeah. Really stayed in my memory. Yeah, no, I think this one's probably a bit easier, but okay. we'll see how we get on. Clue number one. Okay. I was born on the 27th of August, 1976.
Tim Henman.
No, it's not Tim Henman, but, you know, good shout. Clue number two. On the 17th of November, 2010, I announced my retirement from tennis because of a long-standing foot injury.
So they probably are around Tim Henman's age. I just actually just naturally just shouted Tim Henman. okay, I'm going to say 2010. Fabrice Santoro?
No. Not bad, though, not bad. I have won 20 career titles.
Ooh, so quite a few. 20. Oh, I think I might know this. Is it Nicolas Almagro?
No, it's not. okay. Did Almagro win 20 titles? I don't know. But no, it's not Almagro.
Yes, he did. All on clay. No.
Oh, yeah. I used to love a bit of Almagro. I used to get really worked up in matches. Okay.
Christian Garin reminds me of Nicolas Almagro for some reason.
Ah,
I don't really know what. Anyway, let's continue. But anyway, yeah.
okay. I am now a coach on the ATP Tour.
Is it? Okay. I think I know. Okay, right. Is it Nicolas Massu?
Ooh, no, it's not Nicolas Matty.
Thought I had it.
Okay, and my next clue is I lost against the player I am now coaching in the quarterfinals of the 2007 French Open.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Wimbledon. I'm going to say, I want to say Ivan Ljubicic.
That's a good guess, but it's not correct, I'm afraid. Okay. I'm just kind of picking for my clues because I think some of them you will instantly get this when I say them. So let's go with this. I am well remembered for a match against Tim Henman at Wimbledon in the first round, which was a 5-set thriller. The fifth set was won 13-11 by Tim Henman. This is obviously pre the days of a, 12-all fifth set tiebreak. Not that that would have made any difference because it'd been the same number of games.
Tim Henman fifth set at Wimbledon. I mean, I follow a lot of Tim Henman matches back in the day. I want to say...
And sorry, that was in 2007. I should have added the year, but I forgot.
Sheng Shalken?
Who's that? Sheng Shalken? I've never heard of that person.
Is that not right?
Should I know who that person is? Oh, God. It's not right, no. Okay, right, next clue. I'm a former world number one and won the French Open in 1998.
Ooh, French Open 1998. Was that Marcelo Rios? 1998. Oh, hang on. I think I know this, actually. Is it Carlos Moya?
Yes, it is Carlos Moya. Way. I was just about to say I've been Rafa Nadal's coach since 2016. Yes, team, part of team Rafa. Big fan of Carlos Moya in this household. Obviously, very successful Spanish player and long time mate of Rafa, coach of Rafa now. And there we go. Yeah, well done. You got there in the end, Joel.
Yes, he was a very, very, very good player. He always wore that. He always loved the sleeveless look to show off his tattoo. Is all I can. I always remember him for.
Yeah, and you were very close, Joel. And you were saying, you know, Ljubicic, Massu. You were definitely on the right path very early on.
Because Ljubicic is in Federer's camp, and he I'm confident he lost him at Wimbledon. So I was like, I was thinking, it's got to be Ljubicic. It's got to be. And then you said French Open, and I was like, it's probably not Ljubicic, but I'll say it anyway.
Anyway, back to the tennis. Listeners, let us know how well you did with that one. I'm sure loads of Rafa fans out there probably got that much sooner than you, Joel. But actually, before we get on, we've got a mailbag question, Joel, which is, I love this one. This is from Topspin Lobber on Twitter. And they have asked us, Joel, a really interesting question. If you could give a miracle run to the French Open title to a current male French player, who would you choose? That's a great question.
That is a very good question. And I think it only has one answer for me. And that is Joe Wilfried Tsonga. Unfortunately, I think he's going to be a player who, when he does retire, will be in that category with, you know, players like David Nalbandian in terms of bags of talent, but didn't ever get a Grand Slam because of the era that they found themselves in. I just think, he had so much ability. You know, he got to the Australian Open final in 2008, but, you know, since then he's got to, I think, four kind of semi-finals across the French Open and Wimbledon. So I feel like he deserves it. And, you know, I feel like if we're in an alternate universe where, you know, injuries weren't a thing, maybe it would have happened. But for me, Tsonga, he's such a great character, a great kind of showman on the court. You know, we've seen some fantastic matches with him at Wimbledon. I always remember that 5-set match he had, I think, with Andy Murray when Andy Murray went and won one of his Wimbledon titles. He had a 5-set match with Tsonga, which I was watching. I remember watching outside my work at a pub on a screen. It just had absolutely everyone captivated. So for me, I would go Joe Wilfried Tsonga.
I think for me, I would say Gael Monfils, just because he's such an entertaining, likeable character. And I think, you know, I love it when the French fans like get behind someone and they're like, are laying left, right and centre. And I think Gael Monfils is just the ultimate guy to sit and watch and get the crowd going with all his shot making and drama. So for me, Monfils, but I would say special mention to Julian Beneteau, because I know he's retired and the question is asking for a current male player, but Julian Beneteau never even won a singles title anywhere. So for him to have a hypothetical miraculous French Open singles title would be exciting. I think he won the doubles there, but, you know, it's a different kettle of fish.
Just so, you know, whenever someone says, you know, whenever, you know, Auger Aliassim loses another final and everyone brings up that Julian Beneteau stat, at least it would give Beneteau that sort of quick-witted response to be like, oh, yes, but did they win a Grand Slam title? And yeah, Beneteau could be like, because I won the French Open. But I think that's Beneteau would be a great shout too.
I would just say I don't actually want these players to win the French Open, because that would mean Rafa didn't win it. So caveat there, as a Rafa fan, obviously, you know, Rafa comes first. But anyway, I know this is just like a hypothetical. So anyway, thanks for the question. I do love those sorts of ones. So anyway, let's get back to the tennis and talk about the Billie Jean King Cup, because it was due to be happening in Budapest, like the finals, which was due to take place last April, and were then supposed to be taking place, I think, later this season. And it was supposed to be a 3-year deal, so it would have been taking place in the city, for the next few years. But they have basically pulled out. They've said we can't stage it safely because of COVID, and that, you know, they're not willing to basically put up the money for this event. It can't be justified, and they're not able to host it at all. So the ITF are now looking at alternative locations.
Interesting, really interesting news. You know, not the news I think, you know, the ITF would have wanted. I'm sure they're pretty unhappy with the Hungarian Tennis Association at the moment, given the, you know, the short, you know, short time frame they're kind of working with now. I think, you know, they're looking to have the finals, you know, at the end of this season, I think, you know, in like November time or whenever. So they're going to have to move pretty sharpish in terms of, you know, finding a kind of replacement. And I'm sure they'll probably get, you know, quite a few kind of suitors kind of put in their applications. But really, yeah, time is of the essence. And I'm sure we've not heard the least of the fallout between, you know, the ITF and the Hungarian Tennis Association. I mean, it sounds, just kind of reading between the lines, it sounds like, you know, the Hungarian Tennis Association, they offered a lot, perhaps, you know, financially, arguably they offered too much to the ITF. And now they've realized they can't do it. And they're sort of using, I feel like maybe they're maybe using COVID as their sort of get out of jail free card, maybe. But anyway, we're in this situation. And now, obviously, the big question, Kim, is where is the Billie Jean King Cup finals going to be held? You know, if it is in November, the tour finals were at the O2. Would that be a suitable venue? Yes, please bring it to London, basically, was my gut instinct.
Yeah, or people are saying the NEC in Birmingham, you know, and I think Glasgow were trying to get the Davis Cup, weren't they? Or a venue in Scotland were trying to get the Davis Cup, but didn't. So perhaps it could go up there. I mean, yeah, it'd be fantastic to have it in Britain somewhere. Otherwise, you know, I'm sure there are a plethora of other arenas, but they need to have quite a few courts, don't they? So that's, I guess, gonna have to be looked into, but hopefully they'll be able to find somewhere to stage it. And yeah, I'd love to have it on home soil and with the potential of fans, but we shall see. I know a lot of people on our Twitter were obviously very hopeful that it would be at home.
I think if it is in the UK, I mean, obviously we would love that. And, you know, it hopefully, you know, our COVID situation is pretty good now and should be, you know, come, you know, later in the year. I guess, yeah, multi-court facility is probably going to be one thing. You know, this isn't just, you know, an exhibition style for the, you know, the top eight players. This is for teams. So I guess the facility is going to have to be bigger. You know, I guess, can the O2 really accommodate that is a question mark, which potentially means somewhere like the NEC or, I don't know, Alexandra Palace, you know, somewhere that has big open space, if they've got availability in their calendar, given it's such short notice, could be an option. The other kind of factor, I guess, at play is, you know, they're probably going to want it at a place where there's going to be home support, i.e. there's going to be a team that they know is kind of guaranteed in the finals, and GB aren't there yet. We're going to be in a playoff. But again, that might be a sort of a thing that the ITF might factor into their consideration.
Yeah, watch this space. We will obviously be reporting it as soon as we hear anything. but yeah, other points in tennis this week, Joel. Barbora Strizkova has announced her retirement from professional tennis. She is due to have a baby. So obviously she was going to be taking some time out for that. But she has said that she's not coming back afterwards. She's going to completely quit tennis for now and, you know, go into the next stage of her life. So yeah, really sad news, because obviously she's, you know, kind of, I mean, not at the peak of her career, but, you know, she was right up there in the doubles still. Obviously won Wimbledon in 2019 with Su Wei Shea and actually reached the semis in the singles that year. So, you know, she's had some amazing results of late, and yeah, it'd be a shame to see her go.
I think the plan is, I think she is going to try and use a protected ranking to play one more event. And I think she's quietly holding that back for Wimbledon. You know, she's got such great memories there. You know, it's a tournament that she holds very close to her heart. So I think that hopefully can give her a proper send off in front of fans. But yeah, it's fun. It's interesting that, you know, it sounds like it didn't, I think this was quite unexpected for the tennis community, but it sounds like, you know, she's, you know, just become a mum, she's given birth, and it's given her a new perspective on life. And as a result of that, maybe she's just kind of thinking about kind of the next steps. But I think, you know, if we look back on her career and, you know, what we kind of remember her for, I think, you know, for me, she's one of those players who was a very good singles player and a very, very good doubles player. And there are not many players, you know, who are like that. And that really did culminate at the, you know, the 2019 Wimbledon, where she won the ladies doubles and got to the semi-finals of the singles. British fans remember she beat Jo Konta in the quarterfinals. But, you know, she's an absolutely kind of fantastic player and an absolutely fantastic, you know, part of, you know, Czech Republic tennis, because, you know, she was part of the, you know, the Fed Cup team that won in 2011, 2012, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2018. She won 22 matches for her country. So it just shows you how much of a, you know, a big influence she had on the, you know, the success of, you know, Czech tennis, and, you know, not necessarily in the singles kind of category, but, you know, the doubles really, it kind of was, you know, she really was a linchpin for the team throughout, pretty much throughout the whole of the, you know, 2010 decade.
Yeah, she's a very significant player, and annoyingly though, yeah, I think she will be remembered for that Konta match at Wimbledon where she beat her.
I know.
Oh, but yeah, great player and always very, very likeable on court as well. So yeah, she will be missed. And I mean, who knows though? I'm very skeptical about retirements because I'm always thinking players are going to change their mind.
You said this last week. You said this last week. But yeah, who knows? I mean, yeah, maybe she'll do a Kim Clijsters, although I don't know what's happening to Kim Clijsters.
I don't know. Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what is. Yeah, I haven't really heard anything from that camp. But that brings us on to, well, let's take a look at Rome before we finish, because it is underway already. And we've got, well, Novak Djokovic is back. He's playing the Rome event. So he's obviously the top seed in the men's side of affairs. Interestingly, he could play Dan Evans in the second round and in a repeat of that Monte Carlo match. And that's if Dan Evans can get through Taylor Fritz, which I say he should get through that one, but you never know. Yeah, what do you make of the men's draw, Joel?
Djokovic, I think, has got a pretty hard draw, to be fair to him. Could face Dan Evans, who beat him in Monte Carlo. He's got Tsitsipas, who's, you know, obviously been very good. Alexander Bublik could play Tsitsipas in the second round. That could be very tasty. Berrettini as well is the ninth seed, and he's in that quarter with Djokovic. So some real big in-form clay court players in that top quarter for Djokovic to you know, battle and come through. Bashilashvili, I mean, Bashilashvili, Berrettini, that is going to be an absolute, I don't want to be a tennis ball in that match, basically. That's just going to be completely very heavy hitting ground strokes, you'd imagine, from the back of the court. And then in that sort of second quarter, you've got kind of Dominic Thiem and Rublev as the kind of standouts. I mean, I was quite impressed with Dominic Thiem in terms of this week getting to the semifinals. I mean, I think he had quite a kind draw, but he showed a very good level, I think, in that loss to Zverev. And I think that was very promising for him. And again, I've no reason, you know, looking again at that quarter, I think that's quite a nice quarter for him. I mean, Rublev could have Struff in the second round as well. So that could also be quite a tough opener for him.
I know this sounds a bit weird, but when I watched a bit of Thiem in the week, I thought, I have a funny feeling he might win the French Open this year. And I know that sounds, it wouldn't sound daft had he not had the last few months that he's had. But I just feel like no one will be thinking about him. They'll have written him off because of his terrible year, and he'll just have no pressure and suddenly turn on the form that we know he can do. And you know, it's like I don't know. Anyway, this is going off course, but I just wanted to get that out there. yeah, we've also got Gael Monfils back, which is nice to see. He's in that team section of the draw. And then the bottom half, Rafa's actually got Zverev as a potential quarterfinal again. So that would be interesting should they meet for the second week in a row. But Rafa does have potentially Jannik Sinner in the second round, which I don't know what Sinner's, you know, Sinner wasn't particularly playing that well last week, you know, had that early loss to Popperin. So we'll see on that one. The Schwartzman Medvedev quarter is the quarter I think anyone could kind of come through that one. Karatsev perhaps, you know, he's still not seeded, Karatsev. You know, he still needs to get his ranking up there a bit higher.
It doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
But I mean, you've got, as you said, you've got you've got Karatsev in that quarter. You've got Salvatore Caruso as well, who has got a wild card, Kim.
He lost today. He lost.
Oh, did he lose today? Oh, okay.
Yeah, sadly.
Big off fan. Okay.
I was
but yeah, that quarter feels wide open. I think Schwartzman will want to, you know, we've not really been speaking a lot about Schwartzman, and you know, I think he'll want to put that right in Rome. So he'll be hoping, I think, for a good run. I saw him today practicing with Andy Murray, who's out there just being like a high profile practice partner to anyone that wants him, really. But I think Schwartzman could have a point to prove. Medvedev has a point to prove, so that feels completely wide open, particularly in that third quarter.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we do have some interesting first round matches lined up, I suppose. I mean, I think the pick of them for me is probably Shapovalov against Casper Ruud. I'd expect Casper Ruud to come through that one, but obviously both, you know, very notable names and a bit of a blast from the past. Kei Nishikori, Fabio Fognini. I think that's quite a classic match there. And Hubert Hurkacz, Lorenzo Musetti as well. So some interesting first round matches. We'll get on to predictions in a second, Joel. Let's just look at the women's draw, because interestingly, we've got Serena Williams is back in action. So haven't heard from her in a while since the Australian Open. So I don't know what to expect, to be quite honest, from her. But all eyes will certainly be on her. And she actually has Naomi Osaka in her quarter. And obviously Osaka hasn't had the best week so far on clay. She hasn't, she hasn't got past the quarterfinals in both of her two events, but obviously I would expect her to do that at some point on clay this season. But the first quarter, we actually as well at the top of the draw have Barty and Sabalenka potentially on course to meet yet again, but in the quarterfinals this time. So obviously I feel like with those two, are they going to get there? I feel like they've both played so much tennis of late, especially Barty. Are they going to kind of fade out? Are they going to be too tired?
I'm not sure. I do think, though, that Barty Sabalenka, when the season finishes, I think we're going to be looking back on the Barty Sabalenka as one of the rivalries that really, you know, has blossomed this season, because they put on some absolutely fantastic matches. But that top quarter again is similarly loaded. You know, quite hard draws, I feel, you know, for Djokovic, but also for Ash Barty, because Elise Mertens potentially could be there in the third round for Ash Barty. Maria Sakkari as well could play Sabalenka in the third round. So some really, you know, again, it's quite loaded in that top quarter. I think the second quarter is a little bit more up for grabs. I mean, Kenin and Svitolina. I mean, Muguruza and Świątek have first round matches. And for me, they are the form players who I sort of would expect to come through and maybe face each other in the quarterfinals. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure how we're seeing Kenin as the fourth seed get to the semifinals, but who knows? You know, she is a French Open finalist.
She is, and she's just sacked her father as her coach this week. So
oh, is that right? Okay.
She has, yeah. So obviously needing to make some changes. You know, she's had a really poor season, but I genuinely, she's the fourth seed, but that's not based on anything current. So I would be looking at Muguruza, Świątek, Karolina Muchova, you know, she's in there unseeded. All of those players. I mean, Pavlyuchenkova, obviously semi-finalist last week. She's up against Muguruza in the first round, which is, you know, a ridiculous first round. You know, in light of that. So, and then the third quarter is Pliskova against Halep. I think this is a decent draw for Halep and Pliskova, to be honest. I mean, he's got Kvitova lurking as well. So I would expect either one of those to make it through to the semis, potentially the final as well, if Serena and Osaka are kind of undercooked on the clay. But we do have some notable exceptions. Andreescu pulled out. We saw that in the Miami final, she, retired from that with an injury. So I feel like she's obviously still giving herself time to come back from that. And Venus Williams as well has pulled out, and which is a shame because she was due to play Pliskova in the first round, which, it is sort of quite mad because Venus won this event in 1999. Pliskova won it in 2019. So, yeah, wow. two winners 20 years apart of that event. They were due to play each other. But actually, that's bumped Pliskova up to take the position of the eighth seeding. So, but yes, I think we should make some predictions, Joel. which we can laugh about in a week. What have you got for your Rome, your Italian Open predictions this week?
So for the men, my two semi-finals are Djokovic Team and Nadal Karatsev. I think Nadal's going to come back strong in Rome, much more friendlier like environment, I feel, for him. And I think Djokovic is going to do Novak Djokovic and just come through it to face Dominic Thiem, who I thought looked very good this week, Barra, Alexander Zverev semi-final. So I think I've got those as my four semi-finalists. I've got a Djokovic-Nadal final, and I've got Djokovic as the winner. I think Djokovic, you know, I know he lost that match to Karatsev in his home tournament, but I think he looked very good. It wasn't a loss where, you know, that sent kind of, you know, flashed sort of warning sirens. I think we've seen Nadal play kind of worse tennis and lose kind of like worsely. Don't even know if that's a word, but but I think Djokovic, he'll come back. I think Djokovic will, yeah, I think Djokovic will come through and win the Italian Open. What about you?
Yeah, it was hard for me not to put him as the winner because, you know, it is Novak Djokovic after all. But I've gone for Djokovic and Thiem, like you. And then I've gone for David Goffin against Nadal in the second semi-final. Because, like I said, there's that third quarter, which I think someone random will come through. And Goffin is the man I've chosen. And then I've got my finalist Thiem against Nadal. For some reason, I think Thiem's going to play lights out again and beat Novak. But I've gone for Rafa to win. And I guess that is wishful thinking, obviously.
The alternative weeks sort of.
Yeah, that's my thinking. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then for the women, Joel, I've gone for Barty Muguruza in the first semi and then Pliskova against Bencic in the second semi.
Wow. Pliskova.
Okay. Well, she has got form at this event. And I just feel like her draw is actually quite decent, apart from maybe Kvitova, but, you know, I'm sure she'll get through it. And I feel like Pliskova Halep in the quarter. I just have a feeling about Pliskova, like she might suddenly do something. Final, I've gone for Muguruza Bencic. I'm not really sure where the Bencic prediction's coming from, but I've gone for Muguruza to win, basically, which I feel like there's quite an out there set of players, perhaps, but, you know, we'll see.
We've not really heard much from Muguruza, so I'd love that to happen. I have gone, in my women's predictions, I've gone with quite a few of the S's. I've gone like trigger happy on the S's. So my first semi-final is Sabalenka-Świątek. I think Sabalenka will come through Barty in that top quarter. And I think Świątek, I think she's looked really good apart from that match against Barty. So I think that will be the top half semi-final. I've got Simona Halep, Serena Williams bottom half semi-final, which could be quite tasty. I mean, I know that, I think that's asking a lot more from Serena Williams and Simona Halep, given, you know, I'm still don't really know. Are we really thinking Serena Williams can win the French Open, or is she more of a, dare I say, an Andy Murray-esque sort of sideshow going on at the moment? I don't know. But I've got her in my kind of semi-final against Simona Halep. But my final is Sabalenka versus Simona Halep, with Halep winning.
Oh, so you think Halep will reverse, you know, the kind of performance against...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay.
But I think Sabalenka won't run out of steam until the final, when Simona Halep will run her ragged and win the title. So that's what I'm going for.
Right. So we'll see how wrong all of those will probably be.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely.
Oh dear. I think that brings us to a close for this week, Joel. Obviously, we will be back next week with a catch up of Rome, which we're very much looking forward to. But until then, I think that's us for another week on tour.
Yes, another week with the passing shot. Absolutely. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this catch up. If you want to stay up to date on all the tennis world, make sure to subscribe to us on your podcasting platform of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Castbox, Stitcher, wherever you listen to us, make sure you hit that subscribe button to stay up to date with the passing shot. And if you have been enjoying listening to the show and want to help help the show out, make sure to leave us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts.
And you can follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Passing Shot Pod. So do give us a like, give us a follow if you don't already. You can message us on there if you've got any questions or any feedback. We always love to hear from all our listeners. And you can also email us as well if you prefer, passingshotpod@gmail.com.
And we will be back next week with another Passing Shot catch-up, taking in all the events from Rome and the Italian Open. We do actually have a special announcement that we're going to be making midweek with regards to the show, with regards to the future of the show. It's very, very exciting news. And we're really excited to kind of share that with you. We'll probably put out a little mini sort of 3-4 minute announcement on Tuesday or Wednesday, so look out for that. But yeah, we'll be posting it on social media as well, so look out for that. It's really, really exciting news, and yeah, see you again soon. Kim, I can't help but notice Paola Badosa. Is she Maria Sharapova in disguise?
Well, there is a certain similarity, isn't there? And I know that she said her idol, you know, growing up was Sharapova. So I can definitely see a bit of that going on. But a Spanish Sharapova.
I really want her. If she wins next title she wins, I want her to like phone her dad and go into the crowd, a la Sharapova at Wimbledon when she was a teenager.
Oh, 2004. Gosh, that was 17 years ago.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.